Who's taglining us?
Welcome to Maintenance Phase, the podcast that trolls the trolls.
Oh, that's good. That's like an actual tagline.
Sure, sort of.
Instead of like an ostentatiously trash inside joke, which is what they usually are. You're Aubrey Gordon.
You're Michael Hobbs.
And here we are.
Here we are. If you'd like to support the show, you're already doing that.
Thank you.
Mike, you had a great idea for a bonus episode.
This was a accidental listener suggestion.
Oh.
One of my favorite things about doing the show is how listeners have like internalized our critiques of things. And so whenever there's like a trash story in the media, like we hear about it from like 75 people.
We do.
They're usually like really insightful. I mean, like this was one that I found out about because our listeners were like, this seems like Mike and Aubrey would think that this was bullshit. Then I looked at it and I was like, this is indeed bullshit. So we thought we'd make a little episode.
It's very fun to me because it's mostly tweets. Sometimes it's emails, mostly it's tweets.
Yeah.
Come from people who are like, I saw this article and I thought Mike would really have a lot to say about the J-shaped curve here and blah, blah, blah. And this methodology doesn't hold up. And Aubrey would say, fuck off. And I'm like, yep. That's about right.
Here we are.
So today, Mike, we are going to do a media roundup. A lot of the media right now is pretty anti-fat. So we're going to talk about some like, you know, stuff that is a little regressive on fat people.
So we each have two media stories to talk about. The idea was that we were going to pick like one good one and one bad one because we don't want to yell about stuff all the time, much as we enjoy that.
Not only.
But then my good one turned out to be kind of bad.
My good one turns out to be, it's complicated. I think this is like, so this feels like a legit challenge of the show.
Right?
It's really hard to find shit that's not trash.
I know. Remember when I was like, Aubrey, I'm going to do a Michael Pollan book so we can finally talk about something unproblematic. Then I read it. I was like,
Oh no, alt-right farmer. Fuck.
So we're going to start with a bad one, and then we're going to do two complicated ones, and then we're apparently going to finish with like a really bad one.
It's a really bad one.
My bad one begins with a tweet, which I am about to send you.
Oh, my bad one begins with a video clip.
We're a multimedia podcast. Okay, this is it.
Ah, fuck, I know this one.
Do you remember this, gentlemen? Yeah.
The tweet is from the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and the tweet reads, "New! As a result of our junk food advertising ban on transportation for London, nearly 100,000 cases of obesity have been prevented since 2019. It's expected to save the NHS over £200 million. An incredible result."
I feel like both of us saw this and sort of knew immediately what kind of study it was.
Yeah.
So, factually speaking, in 2019, Transport for London, which is the organization that runs the tube and all the buses in London, decided to ban all advertising for high-fat, salt, and sugar products from transport. So like, you know, advertisements on the sides of buses. And then when you take the escalator up and down the tube, there's like every foot, basically, there's like a big old poster.
Yeah.
It's usually like fast food, like large corporations, Burger King, Pepsi, what you would expect of like a mass public advertising kind of space.
Sure. Maltesers.
Exactly.
Crunchy bars. I'm trying to think of English candy. Arrow.
EastEnders. Lori.
Bovril the vegan Marmite. What a bummer.
So this particular study is not really based on very much. So it's basically an extrapolation from a household survey of around 1,000 households in London that were compared to 1,000 households in the north of England. They don't say like where specifically, but they basically wanted to find a community that was like least likely to have seen or not seen ads on the tube in London. Mm. So we always complain about self-reported studies. So this was not a self-reported study. It's some sort of consumer survey where they give a bunch of families barcode readers. And so when these folks go to the grocery store, when they come back and like take everything out of their grocery bag, they bloop it. And then that data goes back to the researcher. So it's actually a fairly good methodology for finding out, like, what are people actually buying? Like, what kinds of foods are actually coming into their homes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't actually measuring what people are eating, right? It's measuring what people are buying in the home.
Right.
We know that in most developed countries, people are eating 30 to 50% of their calories out of the home.
Yeah.
So if you're scanning the barcodes of everything that you're bringing home, that's not counting restaurants. It's not counting school lunches for the kids. The authors of the study actually say that, like, nothing about this should be used for anybody under 16 because they're eating so much outside of the home. Or, like, if they buy a candy bar on the way home and they eat it before they get there. So it's like there's a huge amount of consumption that this isn't capturing.
So this feels like essentially a consumer behaviors study.
Right. Right.
What impacts sales, not what impacts people's eating overall, and certainly not how that eating impacts their body size.
Right.
It just feels like there are so many steps of that logic sort of missing from the research design to this tweet. It feels like there are like 10 steps and they've got like two of them.
But then, okay, what's wild is the underlying data of the tweet is based on two studies.
Uh-oh.
And the one we just talked about was like the good one. So,
Uh-oh.
In that original study, based on the barcodes, they found that over the course of 2019, so the same year that they banned the ads on the tube, everybody consumed less. People in the North purchased 0.6% fewer calories, and people in London purchased 1.5% fewer calories. Again, that's purchases. We don't know the consumption, but whatever. That's what they found in that survey. And then another set of researchers took that original survey and then they extrapolated what if everyone in London had the same consumption pattern as the people in that survey. So based on this data, the model predicts that if everybody in London ate like the people who answered the survey, there would be 95,000 fewer individuals with obesity in London and 2,800 cases of diabetes and 1,900 cases of cardiovascular disease would have been prevented compared to people in the North.
Huh.
So what's interesting about this is that they predict that there would be 4.5% fewer people with obesity, but that's not a reduction of obesity by 4.8%. It's 4.8% lower than it would have been if advertisements had not been banned on the tube and the buses. So it's like this ends up in the media as obesity has gone down by 4.8% in London, which is not true. Of course it's not true.
Yeah, inaccurate.
What it's actually saying is that according to the model that we made up,
yeah,
we prevented these like hypothetical people from getting fat, but it's not based on any actual real data on anything. It's exclusively an extrapolation from this underlying survey data. So it's pure, just like made up numbers, basically.
Right. And there's no actual real world evidence that shows a causal relationship between advertising and body size at a population level.
Yeah. What this survey and this model don't actually ask people is how much were you taking the tube? How many of these advertisements were you seeing? If taking junk food advertisements out of public transit was affecting people, well, you'd see a much larger effect on people who take public transit every day.
Yeah.
But that's not what they're finding. This is just literally people in London.
Yeah.
But like, that is some weak shit. Like, if you can't even say on the most basic level, people who take the tube lost more weight than people who don't take the tube. Like, that's a much more useful comparison.
Sure. And also, even then, I would still be like, oh, I'm sorry, what now?
Well, yeah, I mean, even,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
We'd be shouting about that too, but we'd be shouting differently.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Less and different shouting. Yeah. I mean, this to me feels like a less dog shit version, but still not great version of that study we talked about in the calories episode that was like, they put up billboards about calorie menu labeling and they asked people if they remembered seeing the billboards and those people said yes. So it's working, everybody.
It worked.
You're like,
we
what?
Did it. But then do you want to hear my hot take on this?
Tell me. I always want to hear your hot take.
I think that this probably had no effect, like banning junk food ads in the tube. But
sure.
I actually think it's a good policy. I think banning junk food ads is fucking fine. Like, I am not, as a person, concerned about like the free speech rights of fucking Burger King and Pepsi.
I mean, I think it's fine to ban any number of kinds of advertising. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, dude, make corporations work harder to, like, fucking fleece you.
I know that in Sweden, and I'm pretty sure there's other countries too, where it's illegal to advertise literally anything to children.
Wow.
Because their little brains can't tell the difference between what's real and when somebody doesn't have your best interest in mind and they're trying to sell you something. So, like, to me, the idea of getting rid of advertisements in public space is totally defensible. If some country just wants to say, like, no billboards, no tube ads, no ads in schools, nothing, who's actually harmed by that, right? Like a bunch of fucking corporations. I don't care.
Yeah, I feel fine about banning various and sundry kinds of advertising. I think the thing that leaves me with a bad taste in my mouth about this one is that it's so specifically targeted at reducing the number of fat people in the world.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
Right? Like, that's the thing that's gross, is the reason they picked this. That's what makes this gross.
Also, I am 99.9% sure that this had no effect whatsoever, because there's so many other ads for junk food in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you go from seeing 25 ads for junk food to 24 ads, I don't think that's going to do anything. And I don't think we should justify policies on this basis. Whereas something like, well, great, we got junk food ads out of the tube. Next TV, right? Next video games.
Great.
Like, to me, that's like, yeah, what's the next frontier for this? Let's do it, because it's a good for society to have fewer propaganda messages aimed at us and aimed at children. I think that's great. But you shouldn't justify them based on bad science, because it's bad science and it's not true.
Yeah, totally. I do think, like, again, like, just fucking corporations can get fucked. Cheetos, fucking stop advertising. Whatever. What's the UK Cheetos? Monster Munch.
Wait, really?
Monster Munch can stop. Yeah, it's called Monster Munch. I have never tried it. By all accounts, it is crunchier. It's sort of like Captain Crunch, where it, like, scrapes the roof of your mouth kind of situation, is my understanding.
Yeah. I had a Tim Tam when I was, like, 19, and then I was like, I'm done, because they're too good. I'm never going to top this.
Fucking Jaffa Cakes.
Dude, Jaffa Cakes are so good. Oh, my God.
Jaffa Cakes are the shit.
Yeah. I was just in the UK, and, like, we stayed at, like, an Airbnb, and they had, like, a welcome box of Jaffa Cakes, and they were gone. Within like 20 minutes.
I will say, I was in the UK when I was like 15, and they had these candy bars in like every store called Yorkie.
Okay.
And the O in Yorkie was like a circle with a slash through it, like, no. And in the circle with a slash through it was like the icon from like a women's bathroom sign, but it was also like carrying a handbag.
What?
And then the slogan was, Yorkie, it's not for girls.
Wait, really?
So I am absolutely just as subject to advertising as any other human being on the planet. And I was like, we'll fucking see about that. And I ate like 5 Yorkie bars while I was in the UK to just be like, I'm a girl, I eat a Yorkie bar. Like, okay.
This is so much better than last time you described a symbol to me. I'm still reeling.
You don't want me to talk about like neo-Nazi symbols again?
That's what I'm like. It has some spokes and it's round. It got real dark. This one sounds fine though.
So my it's good slash complicated came to me by way of the family vacation that I was on when we recorded the Scarsdale diet episode.
Oh, yeah.
This op-ed was published in the Washington Post, published on July 28th. The title of the op-ed is, what if the focus on calories and energy balance is simply wrong?
Okay.
It is written by a researcher named David Ludwig, who's a co-director of an obesity prevention program at a children's hospital, which is like pretty dark, and a professor of nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health, which, as we know,
friend of the
is
show.
Being fat bad for you. Yeah, friend of the show. Essentially, this op-ed is sort of like announcing a study that has come out that challenges the energy balance model, which is also known as calories in, calories out.
Mm-hmm.
He also includes some, you know, information that I think would like blow some fucking minds of Washington Post readers. So I'm just texting you a quote.
It says, for a century, this energy balance notion has dominated obesity prevention and treatment. If this theory is correct, though, it's hard to square with the facts. After more than a 3-decade increase, calorie consumption in the United States has plateaued or decreased since 2000, a new analysis concludes. But obesity rates have increased by more than 1/3 since then, to an astounding 42% of the population today. This paradox can't simply be explained by our sedentary lifestyles. In fact, Americans have become somewhat more physically active over the past 20 years. Okay, so we're eating less and we're moving more, but we're getting fatter, basically.
Yeah.
And so calories in, calories out, we need something more complex than that.
This feels like a genuinely helpful thing to have a researcher say in a national newspaper, to be like, hey, we're wrong on this. Like, almost certainly we're getting this wrong, or it's very likely. Essentially, the sort of thesis statement of this op-ed is, we are pretty sure that calories in, calories out is just wrong, and it's powered in some ways by bias, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, it's much easier for us to believe that fat people are just, like, bad at eating, because it reinforces a bunch of our conceptions about fatness and fat people and character and morality and all that kind of stuff, right? The op-ed ends with a call for more research into an insulin resistance or low carb model.
Oh.
Right. But call for more research, not that's why you gotta eat low carb, right? Like, it was just like,
okay,
we've had a bunch of research into calories in, calories out, and way less into low carb sort of insulin resistance models. And we should even that up before we can really say what's going on here, which feels like reasonable. There are a few things that made me stay with this. First, my mom read this op-ed when we were at the coast on this big family trip, and showed it to a friend of hers and was like, hey, check this out. Her friend is, like, very into Weight Watchers world. And her friend read the article and, like, handed my mom back her laptop and was like, so they're just saying you got to do Atkins.
Nice.
Part of the way that this will get slotted into people's brains is as, here's another person arguing in favor of low carb in the low carb versus low-cal wars that have been going on since the last, whatever, 50 years, right? But also, like, it's coming from an obesity prevention guy, right? Quote unquote. It wasn't ever going to just, like, take a minute and be like, we don't know much about this topic, which is what I would have loved.
It's not a paradigm shift, because the paradigm shift is still within, we need to bring obesity rates down. So that's still the kind of the frame that all of this information is going into.
Right. So, like, I think there are a few things that, like, feel really challenging to me about this piece. Not like deal breaker, end of world, the worst thing ever things, but just like not great. One is that it's continuing this sort of search for quote unquote the diet that works, which is an email that we get daily is someone goes, when are you going to talk about the ones that work? And I'm like, no,
but we don't have
that
those.
Doesn't exist. And that's definitely not our show.
Yeah.
It's also furthering this sort of rhetoric that, like, fat people need to be fixed and that we're a social problem or sort of a social blight. Right. It doesn't really interrupt that in a meaningful way. It does do this thing about, like, we're all judging fat people and our research is designed based on those judgments, which is, again, like, a helpful thing to say. But again, the article still ends with, that's why we got to look at this other way to make fat people thin. And you're like, that part feels
less
good.
Yeah, it's still,
And the last one is, it still totally fucking scapegoats fat people. Here is another quote for you to read. The first one, pretty good, pretty interesting, pretty helpful. Second one, here you go.
It says, scientists are supposed to be skeptical. But when variations of the same approach keep failing and rates of obesity keep going up, it's critical that new ideas are encouraged, not suppressed. And with the cost of just one weight-related complication, type 2 diabetes, almost $1 billion a day, we must consider different ways of solving the intractable problem of obesity and open our minds to a radical-sounding notion: overeating is a symptom, not a cause. This is my favorite thing, when they're like, we need to try something radically different, and then they just stay the same thing that is already conventional wisdom.
Yep.
Like, what if we tried considering obesity to be a disease?
Right. That's been the status quo for a solid 20 to 30 years at this point. What?
Exactly. What does this lead to? I mean, I guess we should do more research of low-carb diets. I mean, fine. But that's still, like, an individualistic paradigm. Like, what if they all find that low-carb diets are great? Okay, well, we've done various low-carb trends in America, and people can't stick with them, and people can't afford them.
Yeah.
So then we're back to where we started, even if the research goes really well.
And even if low-carb diets reliably produce thinness, which they don't, even if people could stick to them, which they can't, and even if we, like, radically reorganized our society around making most foods low-carb and changing our subsidies and changing our advertising and all of that kind of stuff, there would still be fat people and there would still be anti-fat bias, right?
Yeah.
And we know for fucking sure that that makes people's health worse on a bunch of fronts, and it makes their fucking lives worse, and it makes more people into gremlins. And, like, I feel like there should be, like, at least as large a societal effort to reduce the number of gremlins as there is to reduce the number of fat people, right? Like, Right. We should be putting some fucking shoulder into that shit rather than just tagging it on as a caveat when we say terrible things about fat people.
You say you're into obesity prevention, but what about gremlin prevention? What about that, doctor?
So the last thing I wanted to say, two more things about this op-ed. One is, I was not familiar with this author of this piece in particular, so I looked him up on Google Scholar. His back catalog is fucking yikes.
What's in there?
In 2009, he wrote an article for JAMA called Obesity and the Economy, From Crisis to Opportunity.
What does that mean?
Quote, even in good economic times, obesity imposes great financial burden on society in the form of higher medical costs and lower worker productivity.
Nice.
The economic downturn can be expected to reduce nutrition quality and physical activity, worsening obesity prevalence when society is least able to bear the escalating financial burden. Congratulations, fat people, you're a financial burden. There's another one that he wrote for the New England Journal of Medicine called Childhood Obesity, The Shape of Things to Come. And he talks about seeing a family in his clinic in Boston. The family has five kids, all of whom were fat and all of whom had things like high blood pressure, fatty liver, dyslipidemia, a bunch of things that we sort of like associate with fat people in our popular imagination, right? Mm-hmm. Here's what he says after that opening paragraph talking about that family.
Sadly, this family might be a microcosm of 21st century America. If we don't take steps to reverse course, the children of each successive generation seem destined to be fatter and sicker than their parents. Oh, another good zombie one. Mm. How will obesity affect the physical and psychological well-being of children in coming decades? What effects will childhood obesity have on life expectancy, the national economy, and our society?
I don't know, man. You're talking about literal children.
Yeah.
What is the message to fat kids? This is an article about fat kids. What's the message to fat kids? And that is, absolutely unequivocally, we're in a whole heap of trouble and it's your fault.
Right.
Like, just fucking let kids be kids without like saddling them as like scapegoats for the fucking economy or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, just like let a kid have a childhood.
Let him have a Jaffa cake. Jaffa cakes whip ass.
I mean, I think part of what feels really interesting about this is that it feels like reflective of this sort of frame shift that's happening in medicine and research around fatness and fat people that is like, hey, we got to quit with the blame and shame and start in with the pity. And you're like, well, pity's not better.
Right.
It's just like, hey, instead of ignoring them with disdain, maybe start ignoring them and being grateful that you're not in their shoes.
Yeah.
That's not how you relate to another human being that you see as like a peer with value.
And it's still under the same framework. Like, I feel like the rhetoric is shifting without an acknowledgement that it's just prescribing the same stuff and casting the problem as exactly the same, which is fatness, and the solution as exactly the same, which is everybody needs to lose weight.
And like, he's right? Like, he's correct that there is an uneven amount of research on calories in, calories out versus low carb insulin resistance. And there remains so fucking pitifully little research on just like, what would it look like to try and keep fat people healthy without trying to make them thin. It is astonishingly incurious.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
To me as a fat person, what this means is that maybe one fewer person says calories in, calories out, and like two more people say low carb to me.
Right.
That's the upshot for me, is that I get more, but a different kind of unsolicited diet advice because people look at me and are like, your body is a problem to be solved. I got the fix, right?
I love that it's like we're embarking on a huge paradigm shift. We're going to make it 2004. When like Applebee's had like a low carb menu, like, wow.
Yeah.
Progress.
And everyone was like, losing weight on bacon and eggs. What? I'll believe it when I see it.
Wait, can I make a really try hard transition into my it's complicated?
Oh my God, I would love it. Try the hardest, please.
It's a bonus episode, so I can do try hard bullshit. Okay.
Let's not act like that stops us on the main feed.
I mean, that's true. I'm also the most fucking tryhard on the main feed as well.
I mean, me too. Me too.
Okay. So what I'm actually very fascinated by with all of this stuff with fat people and the way that this is now being framed is that we're in this transitional period.
Mm.
Every marginalized population goes through this, where there's a time when sort of outright bigotry is acceptable. Mm. And then at the end of the road, there's a time when quote unquote equality is there in law and in practice and in society, et cetera, right? But in between, you always have a couple decades where it's like two steps forward, one step back. People have complicated feelings. People are holding on to some latent bias.
Mm.
And so because I've been reading all this stuff about the gay marriage debate from the 1990s, and because my friend Matt Baume is like a really good video essayist and he makes videos about gay history, basically, he just did a video on, you know, the Seinfeld episode where everybody thought Jerry and George were gay? You remember this thing that they did, like, not that there's anything wrong with that.
Yes.
Basically, it's a bunch of straight guys who don't want to be seen as homophobic, and, like, their views are transitioning on gay people, but it's also very important to them that nobody thinks they're gay.
Right. They don't want to be seen as homophobic, but they are having an extremely homophobic response.
Exactly. But, like, that to me is such a fascinating metaphor for, like, these transition phases, right? Where it's like, these aren't two guys that are walking around saying gay slurs. Like, something is changing in their consciousness, but there's still a lot of, like, deep-set, latent homophobia.
Mm.
That tension is still there. And I think because you and me grew up during this period, it's, like, really easy to memory hole this, just, like, how deeply uncomfortable people were with gay people.
Astonishing.
You couldn't say slurs anymore. Like, that was not how you were experiencing homophobia, but you were feeling it in this way that, like, I remember a friend of mine got really upset once when somebody thought he was my boyfriend, a straight guy. He was, like, really upset.
So my version of this was going away to fucking college, meeting my roommate for the first time, and wanting to be upfront with her because there was no real way to do this through the college. I couldn't be like, hey, I'm a gay person. Can you just tell them ahead and they can have their freak out on their own time? Like, that was not an option. So I, like, got there and on day one was like, hey, I'm here and also I'm gay. And this person was like, oh, I'm totally fine with that. I'm in musical theater. Like, don't worry about it. Okay. I'm surrounded by gay people all the time. And I was like, oh, cool. And then fully, like, when we were getting ready for bed that night, she was like, my mom had a lesbian roommate once who tried to climb in bed with her. And if anybody tried to do that to me, I would stab them.
Wait, really? She said this to you?
Yes! And I went to the university and they were like, well, she didn't threaten you.
Right.
And I was like, what the fuck, man? What do you think is the point of that remark? There are two people in the room. Fuck!
I also feel like as a member of the minority group that's in, like, the target of the transition period, it puts you in this weird position where you sort of have to, like, congratulate people for views that, like, you don't really hold, but it's, like, it's progress. Like, I remember people saying to me, like, I'm okay with gay people as long as they don't rub it in my face. And I'd be like, thank you.
Right.
That was progress. You're like, I'll take it. All day long, I will take that because that is so much better than what this person was saying 6 months ago. But it's like, that's objectively bad.
I got that fully on doors at one point when I was canvassing on non-discrimination to try and get a law passed saying you shouldn't be able to fire somebody because they are gay or trans, or you think they are gay or trans. And someone on the doors was like, I'm fine with gay people as long as they aren't prancing around in the office. And I was like, do you work with a gay horse? What's happening? This seems like it's about more than just, like, gay people. It seems like it's about one person in particular.
Just say you're okay with gay people, but you hate Jeff. You work with Jeff. He's really annoying. It's fine. I get it.
He's in the next cubicle over and you're sick of having to look at his happy marriage while yours is falling apart. Got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
So, okay. So this is finally, this was like try hard corner with Mike. This is finally coming back to the article that I wanted to talk about. Every 10 years or something, we get like a big article about like the state of obesity, right? Do you remember there was a HBO documentary called The Weight of the Nation?
Yes,
in,
Jesus
like,
Christ,
2005
yes.
or something. And in the same way, like they keep rebooting James Bond every couple of years. And like the way that they reboot him, like says something about where we are as a society.
Mm.
USA Today just published this 6-part series that's like trying to be definitive. They interviewed more than 50 experts. I don't know how many actual fat people they interviewed, but quite a few. There's like a lot of sources in this. They read really widely. They're trying to do like, this is like the state of obesity right now, right? It's called Inside America's Obesity Epidemic, How America's Weight and Weight Loss Aren't So Simple. And to me, it's such a fascinating snapshot of like where this issue is and all of like the weird cognitive dissonance that is still at the heart of this weird transition period that we're in. So this is kind of like the thesis statement of the article. Two paragraphs. First one, the vast majority of people find it almost impossible to lose substantial weight and keep it off. Medicine no longer sees this as a personal failing. In recent years, faced with reams of scientific evidence, the medical community has begun to stop blaming patients for not losing excess pounds. This paragraph could appear on our show, right? It's like the science says it's nobody can lose weight. We should all be nicer. Second part of the nut graph. Still, there's a lot at stake. Obesity increases the risk for 200 diseases, including heart disease, diabetes, asthma, hypertension, arthritis, sleep apnea, many types of cancer. Obesity was a risk factor in nearly 12% of U.S. deaths in 2019, which actually doesn't seem like that many deaths for all the panic that we get over obesity. 12% doesn't seem like that many, but whatever. So it's like back-to-back paragraphs. It's like, well, nobody can lose weight. We should all be nicer to fat people. And they're all going to get cancer and they have asthma and diseases, blah, 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 blah.
Right. It goes right from, hey, we're not blaming fat people anymore, right into, here's all the things that you should say when you blame fat people.
But then, okay, there's six parts of this article, and we're not going to spend this much time on every part, but I want to kind of walk through them briefly because I think it's fascinating the way that it zigzags back and forth.
Let's do it.
Part two is called Extra Weight Increases Risks in the Long Run. Fat shaming hurts now. So this is like the stigma section. And it starts with an anecdote from Tigris Osborne, who's the chair of National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance.
Yeah, Tigris is great.
Yeah. The opening sentence of this section is Tigris Osborne is fat and she's okay with that. And then it lays out the argument that we make on this show. The health impacts are very complicated and being mean to fat people is just like very obviously bad for them. It interviews Rebecca Poole, who does a lot of work on weight stigma. It interviews a doctor who says that fitness is much more important than fatness. And then we get to the end where it gets to some of the worst both sides-ing I've ever seen. So it's talking about the growing fat acceptance movement. And it says, now, some of the stigma is coming from the other side as well, with people getting blasted on social media and elsewhere for going public with their attempts to lose weight.
What? We've gone too far?
We've gone too far.
Fuck off.
I think that, like, again, this represents such a shift, right? Because I remember when the Weight of the Nation documentary came out, there was a section on weight stigma that was left on the cutting room floor. It was like an online-only bonus. I remember watching.
Jesus Christ.
Weight stigma was like a fucking footnote. It was like an asterisk, right? And now we're in this place where weight stigma isn't in the overture. It's not the nut graph. It's not in the kind of the main thing, but it's the number two chapter.
It's not the overture, but it's the bridge.
Exactly. But there's also this weird thing of like, well, now the pendulum has swung this other way. Where if you post that you're like doing Whole 30, some people are going to yell at you and call you fat phobic for losing weight, which isn't fucking true, by the way, and is not remotely comparable to like every institution of medicine and public health continuing to use the BMI, continuing to tell people to lose weight. Like random people on Instagram do not have any social power.
Also, like a real radical take, sometimes people say unpleasant things on the internet.
Right.
By the way, those fucking comments are not people blasting you. Like when I see those comments, it's someone being like, hey, just a heads up, you might want to consider that this is like really triggering to people with eating disorders. Or like, hey, FYI, I know you might not have thought about it in these terms, but this feels really bad to read as a fat person or blah, blah, blah. Like, it's like the gentlest of corrections.
Right.
For the most part, when people raise this issue, they know how huge the blowback can be, especially fat people.
Yeah.
So it is couched to the nth degree.
Right. Whenever minorities are asking for civil rights, the counterclaim from members of the majority is always like they're fragile and they're going to like melt down if you like misgender somebody or whatever. It's like members of marginalized groups are just about to blow up at you at all times, right? But then as the member of one of these groups that's in this transition period, so much of your life is built around avoiding the fragility of the members of the majority.
Yes.
Your role in any of these conversations is like so much more complex and also much more fraught because they have societal power on their side and you don't. So you can't seem like you're too angry. You can't seem like you're argumentative because they're going to cast you as representative of your entire group.
Right.
Also, if you post, like, I don't know, a swimsuit photo and you're like trying to lose 30 pounds by the summer, you will get 99% positive responses. Like, the number of people who are going to be like, you're fat phobic for that, vanishingly small.
And like, if you do lose weight, you'll get fucking higher pay and you'll get more affirmation your family.
Yeah.
Like, no, someone was mean to me once on Instagram or said something nicely that felt true to me and critical, and that made me feel bad about myself. I think it's probably a clearer illustration of the mechanism that's happening here. Mike, can I just, this is how I feel right now. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Oh wait, what was that? I was expecting your little soundboard.
I got a slide whistle.
You're sitting next to a fucking Drive Time Radio soundboard right now.
I'm building one out of $2 prizes from a toy store is what I'm doing.
Morning Zoo with Aubrey and Mike.
Junk and the Gooch. Yeah, there you go.
So, okay, the next section of this piece is called What We Eat Matters. Researchers Search for the Best Diet, which we're not going to talk about because it's kind of wrote boilerplate, like, we don't really know what the best way to eat is. Fine.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a section called People Don't Choose to Be Fat. They live in a system they don't control, which is a section about race and about intersectionality and about how it's poor people who have the highest obesity rates. And like, again, this is the kind of thing that was not appearing in these big state of obesity articles 10 years ago.
Yep.
It's talking about how difficult it is to afford fresh food. It profiles a low-income black dude who's been fat his whole life, and then he has a heart attack, and he's now enrolled in this, like, hospital program that is helping him have, like, better habits and, like, stop drinking soda and go walking 30 minutes a day, and it's kind of this guy's story.
Mm.
And they interview the researcher who is administering the program, and this whole kind of section is totally fascinating to me. It says, Clark of Indiana University recently helped lead a study trying to unpack the habits, behaviors, and patterns that lead to weight gain among people of limited income. All the participants were enrolled in Healthy Me, the same program Brown joined, and half received 8 to 12 text messages a day asking about their food and exercise-related activities and offering tips for healthier behaviors. Neither group lost weight by the end of the 6-month study. So this is a fairly normal result. You have a hospital-based weight loss program. You would enroll a bunch of people. It's something light touch, right? You get a text message like, don't forget to drink water today. Lo and behold, nobody loses weight.
Did I hear that right? That they're getting 6 texts a day?
8 to 12.
Motherfucker, if you didn't have an eating disorder before.
My mind didn't go there. My mind went to all of the group chats that I have muted because they're like buzzing in my pocket too much. I'm sure that this is the kind of thing that gives people orthorexia. It also seems like the kind of thing that is just so annoying.
What you're listening to now is me realizing in real time that I'm almost always on mute with Mike.
No, you're...
I am an enthusiastic texter.
We are close friends are allowed to text me.
Okay.
Okay, so we've just learned that this guy, Clark, did this program, texts, didn't work, right?
Mm.
This section ends, listen to this, it says, for his part, Clark said every hospital in the country could be offering personalized programs such as Healthy Me to help people like Brown learn and practice healthier habits. The obesity epidemic, he said, isn't going to be solved at the individual level.
Well, then why the fuck are you giving people individual fucking healthy habits?
Told us this fucking program didn't work. He's like, oh, we tried this program called Healthy Me, and it's just a complete failure. And then 3 paragraphs later, our happy ending is like, if only more hospitals had this program. Why? It doesn't fucking work.
Right. We came up with this thing that doesn't work, but let me sweeten the deal. It is scalable.
Like, we can do it more. This is another weird piece of cognitive dissonance that you always get in these articles. It's like all of the dry statistics you're getting is weight loss doesn't work, right? But then all of like the 3-dimensional interesting human stories you're getting are of people who successfully lost weight. So what are people going to remember?
Well, it's just wild because the thing that articles like this are invested in above all else, like really and truly, the thing that they are most invested in is reinforcing the worldview of thin people who have never been fat.
Right.
The conclusion of this, the implicit conclusion, if all the stories are about fat people losing weight, is you can lose weight, you just have to try. And the problem with fat people is that you're just not trying because they're just lazy and they don't want to. There is not an assumption baked into this article that is charitable to fat people, as far as I can tell.
The final chapter of this big, monumental, definitive piece on obesity is called How Will the Obesity Epidemic End with Kids?
Motherfucker.
And because we're in this transitional period, it actually has a lot of stuff that I like. It profiles, I think it's the mayor of a city that's like trying to increase green space. And it's talking about how incomes, like this child tax credit that they had for part of last year, actually food insecurity went down in a lot of poor families, but then it got taken away. It's basically talking about like the links with poverty, like how we can make it easier for people to walk more and bike more. Mostly good stuff. And then I'm going to send you the ending. These are the last paragraphs of the story, and we're profiling this. I think she's like a nutritional counselor, but it begins with her last name.
Okay. McNear, who has been caring for children for 60 years, 20 of them professionally, said she tries to educate her parents along with their kids. Quote, "You have to pull them in too, but do it in a loving way," she said. She keeps a lending library of nutritional information. She quizzes parents whose child is gaining weight about what they're eating at home and tells those who can afford healthy food that it's worth spending a little more to make sure their child gets the best start in life. And she's careful not to stigmatize her kids. Quote, "I don't use the word fat here," she said. "I just tell them we might be a little fluffy. We don't criticize, we don't bully, we all come in different shapes and sizes." Michael? Like, I hate it so fucking much. We don't tell them good things about being fat because that runs counter to the message that we've got here, right? We don't tell them it's okay because clearly it's not. Our whole thing is like, it's not okay that you're fat.
Right.
So we can't say that in a full-throated way. Instead, we do the fucking trash-ass thing that every fucking person on the planet does when they think they're being nice to fat people, which is like, treat us like shit, but don't say fat to our face. And I'm like, that is not the problem.
And also, as like a journalistic act, right? Like the last couple paragraphs, this is usually where the journalists put in like what they actually think. Because you know no one's reading by that point other than like your mom. So it's like you use a quote from somebody that's like, this is what I actually want to say. The fact that this article ends with, "We don't criticize, we don't bully, we all come in different shapes and sizes." That's not fucking true because the whole rest of the article was about how Americans should be different shapes and sizes.
Right.
Again, we are trying to have it both ways. We want to be all like body positivity and like all the colors of the rainbow, shapes and sizes, but you should change your shape and size. That's the fundamental premise of the article. And like, there's no attempt to reconcile these like completely contradictory ideas.
There's this fantastic book by Wendy Brown, who's a theorist out of Berkeley, called Regulating Aversion, and it's about the tolerance model of like relating to marginalized communities. And it's just about the like fundamental ineffectiveness and sort of paradoxical nature of that model, right? Which is sort of like the thing I always think about is like you're trying to hold someone at arm's length and also say that you're embracing them.
Right.
And the tone of this and of the Washington Post op-ed really feels like it's trying to sort of have it both ways.
Well, what kind of clicked with me was there's like little boxes in the text of like, you know, little like breakout little things. And one of the boxes is called healthy weight tips. And they're all fine. It's like, don't think about your weight. Like try to eat fruits and vegetables. Like try to move, find something you enjoy. Try to get a good night's sleep. They're just health tips, but they're marketed as healthy weight tips. So I think the driving force behind this is all of this stuff about like, humans come in all shapes and sizes, is the minute you accept yourself, you'll start to lose weight.
Ugh.
If you stop doing fad diets, right, you'll shift to something more sustainable, and then you'll lose weight because you'll get rid of the shame, you'll get rid of the stigma, right?
You'll naturalize to your beautiful, equal proportions.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think people verbalize it, but I think somewhere in there, it's like we should be nice to fat people because that's the way to get them to not be fat anymore.
It's a like you catch more flies with honey than vinegar.
Yeah, because why else would you say like we celebrate all body sizes, we'd like your body to be smaller. The only way to reconcile it is I'm going to tell you your body is fine the way that it is. And by me telling you that, you'll get the self-esteem that you need.
To make it the way I think it should be.
Exactly. I think that's what's actually going on. This is the only way that I can, like, understand the psychology behind pieces like this.
That's dark as fuck. To be like, hey, man, if you're nice to them, they'll listen to you when you tell them that they're going to die.
It's like the reason that losing weight is hard isn't all the, like, biological stuff that we've all covered. It's because you don't love yourself enough.
Jesus Christ.
Have you tried loving yourself?
I hate this, Mike.
What's weird is that, like, this is still, like, some progress because it's still saying you should be nice to fat people. It's saying you should be nice to fat people for, like, really paternalistic and gross reasons.
Right.
But you should be nice to fat people for these dumb fucking reasons is better than you should be mean to fat people. It's very similar to I'm fine with gay people as long as they don't rub it in my face. Like, two completely contradictory ideas, but, like, I'll take it because you're not yelling a fucking slur at me.
Right. I mean, it's better, but it's also more insidious, right? Like, it's less overt is the way to think about this, right? Because now I feel like what we have is the worst of the worst fucking trolls on the internet still go, of course we shouldn't be mean to fat people, but, and then say the most horrific shit they were going to say anyway. So some ways it's also like creating a model for people to hang on to their absolute trash garbage behavior.
Right.
If you say, I don't think we should be mean to fat people, and then use that as an entry point to say horrible, mean shit to fat people, then like, as a fat person, that has changed not anything for me. It just tells me that now you feel secure enough in your own identity as a good person that I can't actually have a conversation with you that's rooted in any kind of accountability.
And also what's amazing to me about this article, and I think the turn that we're seeing, is that, of course, the article wants to, you know, make itself seem important. So it says like there's a huge shift. There's a transformation going on. Mm. The way we think about this issue is totally different. And then they just repeat the same boilerplate stuff mostly with like a thin veneer of like, this fat lady's cool with being fat.
One time a fat person was nice to me.
Exactly.
Later in the article, the journalist is like, you know what I decided to look into is a promising new policy called menu labeling. I got a real good feeling about this one.
She actually mentions this, Aubrey.
What?
She has a whole section about front of packaging labeling. Well, now that we're all worked up, do you want to talk about your trash article that we were going to end with?
Oh, I wonder. I might be on the next episode being like, Aubrey had a rage heart attack and now she's like in that fucking hospital program.
Oh my God.
All right. So I'm going to send you a clip. It's queued up and we're going to watch until 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Oh, this fucking thing.
Yeah. Have you watched this clip?
Yeah. I drafted a tweet about 30 fucking times for this. But then they all just ended up being like, fuck this dude, fuck this dude, fuck this dude. Like, I couldn't like articulate anything more interesting than that. I was like, all right, I'm just not going to say anything about it because it's so gross.
Bill Maher is America's Piers Morgan, which is to say he's terrible in a profoundly uninteresting way.
So uninteresting.
It felt worth talking about this to kind of put it to bed so that we don't have to talk about it more.
Absolutely. Fuck this dude. Fuck this clip. All right, let's count us down.
Okay, you ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
There's a disturbing trend going on in America these days. Rewriting science to fit ideology or just to fit what you want reality to be. We've gone from fat acceptance to fat celebration. That's new. That is new. To view letting yourself go as a point of pride? We used to at least try and be fit and healthy, and society praised those who succeeded. Now the term body positivity is used to mean I'm perfect the way I am because I'm me. It's Orwellian how often positivity is used to describe what's not healthy. Of course you can get away with anything bad for you when you're young, but let me ask you this. Have you ever seen a fat 90-year-old?
Jesus Christ.
Tell me your thoughts and feelings.
The meta narrative is always the same of there is a marginalized group, discrimination against which is like extremely well documented, a group that faces severe stigma. What if we're too nice to them? This is what we see on group after group. If you go back through history, you see it on Jews, you see it on black people, you see it on gay people. It's the same fucking thing. And he's doing this, like, what if fat acceptance has gone too far? Has it, Bill?
He cranks out pieces like this every couple of years. One of my last columns at Self was addressing a segment that he did where he was, like, calling for the return of fat shaming. And his, like, very tenuous peg for that was, like, there's a presidential debate coming up and no one's going to talk about the biggest issue. That, like, our healthcare system is falling apart and it's all because of fat people and we won't just put down a burger and blah, 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 blah.
When will someone bravely shame fat people? Why haven't we tried this yet?
Decades to centuries of treating fat people like shit.
It's so funny to me how he always does this shtick where he presents, like, the most conventional wisdom as, like, forbidden truths. I'm just gonna come out and say it. Fat people need to lose weight. And it's like, that is the opinion of, like, literally everyone with power in America right now.
This really takes the wind out of my big announcement, which is I'm prepared to bravely announce that I like Beyonce.
Right, exactly. Baths are nice.
Harry Styles has good songs. Sure, man. Okay. My general approach to this stuff is that it is so fucking thirsty for attention. And yeah. So fucking thirsty for controversy when it is fundamentally not controversial. It's fundamentally regressive. It's not worth debunking this because, you know, it's like a person saying mean shit in a mean voice. Like, I don't know what else you need. Like, you don't need to fact check that guy. He's just being a dick in public.
Yeah, he didn't come to these views from research.
His research is, have you ever seen a fat 90-year-old? And I would go, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have. That's a kind of person that exists on this planet. What are you talking about?
Also, morbidity for fat people is actually lower after age 70.
Like,
for reasons
fuck
that
off, dude.
Always totally clear. But it doesn't matter. He's not. That's not what he's here for. That's not what he's trying to do, right?
No, he's not. He's not.
Can I say, I wish that I had stopped watching Bill Maher because of, like, his views. But the real reason I stopped watching Bill Maher, this was probably 20 years ago, was because he does a thing that he does in this clip where he tells a joke that isn't very good and then he just pauses and he waits for the audience to applaud.
Sorry.
What was that? What was that?
I had the slide whistle in my mouth and I laughed. Leave it in.
I thought there was like a mouse that you stepped on.
Yeah, that was the sound that you heard. Sorry. I just was like, I'm a fidgeter when we record, and my current fidgeting involved like putting slide whistle back in my mouth, and then I laughed, and it made a real big sound.
I feel like that's the last word on Bill Maher. Boop.
No, this is, wait, I have two last words on Bill Maher. Are you ready?
Do it.
Okay, hang on, I'm gonna try.
What?
I have to not laugh to do this. Oh no.
You lost
it. Oh no, I can't do it one-handed. Okay, hang on. But like, yeah, man, every bad sound effect I have for this guy. Like, he sucks. He's trying to suck.
Yeah, he's the worst.
So just like going all in on that feels like, bah, I'm good. You know?
I think we got it, Aubrey. I think we're ending with the flute. I don't know if we're going to top that.